gonna start it off this week? AJ, are we gonna start off real quiet? Are we gonna get real loud? Are we gonna get real quiet? Are we gonna get real loud? Are we gonna get real quiet? We don't know. Can I get an amen? Amen. Hey guys, welcome to the Coogan Chronicles podcast, a podcast where two former child actors
try to perform on a podcast, just perform monologues that we've made up, improvised monologues as an intro. And we also interview other former child actors.
We do that too. We do. But before we perform prior. That's the plight of the child actor. You can't ever stop performing ever. It'll never leave you. 90 years old, you'll be putting on a show. That's what happens. And we find out all about it. We find out if kids can stop performing, especially kids like today's guest, Robert Eiler, who has not been a professional actor since he was a kid. He stopped, and we'll get into all that with him. Before we get into it, I appreciate you guys going with my volume control issues. We're still figuring it out. That's it. That's all this is. We're figuring it out.
Chris, this week I wanted to talk about, because Robert's story is so interesting, and I think people are really going to enjoy this episode, but I wanted to talk about the difference between being on a kid's show versus being on something that adults watch and how the rest of the world interacts with you when you're a kid performer or a kid actor. Because Robert's experience being a kid actor on The Sopranos, as he tells us these stories, I realized this, was so completely different from anything that I ever experienced having been on the Disney Channel. And a big part of that is, you know, adults are the gatekeepers to the rest of the world. So if you want access to clubs or you want access to events or other things, of course, adults are the people giving you that access. And when they watch your show and they love your show, they're like, in Robert's stories, they welcome home with open arms. And in my experience on the Disney Channel, nobody gave a shit.
No adult cared. The guy at 7-Eleven was like, yeah, get off the curb. Yeah, exactly.
Now, when you got in there and if there were other 14-year-olds around, they'd be like, oh, that's the guy from the thing. Yeah.
So there's a reason why every kid from High School Musical is like the biggest social media influencer of all time.
Yeah, because social media is only 14-year-olds.
Exactly. You know, and everybody, you know, you're right. I mean, I didn't realize that as we were talking to Robert, but you're totally right. I mean, I've always said, right, that performing as a child in adult content does give you a completely different career than it would if you're a child actor performing in kids content, for sure. There's different hurdles. You cross different lines. Quite often, the most famous actors as adults, if they were kid actors, they performed in very adult oriented movies and television shows as kids, you know, DiCaprio, right. Natalie Portman, Jodie Foster, you know, Christian Bale, they were in these, you know, Spielberg, Scorsese, Clint Eastwood-esque, you know, or the, you know, Leon the Professional, you know, these very heavy adult movies that children don't watch, but adults do. And so they're very welcomed into the adult world and the adult entertainment industry. You know, they're not the porn industry. The adults in the entertainment industry are allowing that, you know, are see them as adults already prior. So if the entertainment industry is doing that, why wouldn't people? I mean, it just seems like it's a natural reaction. And you're right. Like for you on the Disney Channel, nobody was opening up club doors to you. And nobody was like, you know, there were no adults being like, hey man, you want to come sit? I'll get you a nice table at the restaurant.
If they were, stay away.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's for sure. It's a trap. That's a Venus fly trap. That is a disgusting trap. Actually, I've never asked you that question. Did you ever experience anything?
I mean, it's a boring answer. The answer is no.
Oh, it's not? Oh, really?
Yeah. That's not like, what you want to hear. You want
the, it's not what I want to hear. Well, yeah, I don't want to hear. No. Obviously, I don't want to hear like, oh, yeah, there's a lot of pedos that were creeping around my life all the time. I definitely don't want to hear that. I've heard that from a lot of people. I definitely have. There are definitely a lot of former kid stars on kid content things that did experience the facet of that. We haven't talked to any of them publicly on this podcast. But
here's the other thing, though, for me is that because I was on one project for a long period of time, and then a lot of the other projects I did were with the same groups of people, I got a good group of people, you know? So I just landed in a good group. It was all cool. There were never any issues. And as a result, I don't have any stories. But if you land in a bad group, of course, you're going to have stories. Or if you're doing a ton of projects, the odds are better that you're going to, you know, run into somebody that is unsavory.
Yeah, and that the fandom of it is going to be way more eclectic. I mean, you know.
Oh, from the fandom point of view, like, I'm sure there were pieces of fan mail that came in from creepy sources and stuff like that. I just can't recall off the top of my head, but there's got to have been some creepy fan mail stuff going on.
I wonder whose job that is to, like, read something and be like, all right, discard this one. Yeah, like, what are they like?
My mother's.
Yeah, was it? I don't know. I feel like there's got to be a system in place that get before it gets to your mom, somebody's got to open it and be like, nope, can't send Bernard's underwear to AJ's mom. Cannot send Bernard from Minnesota's underwear off to AJ's mother. We got to scrap that before it gets to them. Yep. Nope, not the Disney Channel. That cannot happen. I'm sure there's a safeguard in place to ensure that that doesn't happen. Yeah, it is fascinating. I don't know how often people do take note of, back to that idea, that when you are a kid on an adult show, especially like The Sopranos, one that's hugely popular, that people, fans, are going to generally accept you as they would any other adult on the show. You know, that they would open your arms the same way they would to Gandolfini, you know, because that's Robert's story. It's like they, you know, he was treated just like Gandolfini was, you know.
Yeah.
He's the mob boss's son.
They really do treat you the same way, for better or for worse, because I know that we've had guests on this show as well that have been made really uncomfortable by how much they were treated like an adult and the expectations. And some of that is like the drama that goes along with stories on set. And I think that that is really true sometimes on the negative sense as well. Like when we had Andrea Bowen on the show and she was talking about all the behind the scenes drama that was going on Desperate Housewives, and fans would come up to her and want to talk to her about some of this drama, or talk to her
drama,
like she was her character, in a way that was just totally inappropriate to be talking to a 14, 15-year-old. And so that's interesting too. So yeah, you get more respect being on adult programming, but also you're
held to that standard. Yeah,
absolutely.
You know? Even if it's in casual conversation. But yeah, you definitely are. I mean, I remember that too, because a lot of the stuff, as you know, I did was a lot of adult-oriented stuff, plays and certain movies. And so I was often put in situations where I feel like people talked to me and asked me questions like an adult, you know, like they really did expect me to have a more sophisticated answer than a 15 or 16-year-old me could provide, quite honestly. Almost all of my
really
experiences were that.
Were you happy to try to provide it though?
No, not in the slightest bit. And maybe that's why I like talking so much now, is because for a long time I felt very paralyzed, because I would be asked questions. I was like, I have no fucking clue, dude. Like, what do you mean? Like, what, you know, like, I remember the first big meeting I had with a big agency. They asked me like, so who are your favorite directors and what kind of movies, what kind of career do you envision for yourself? And I was like, what? Like, I audition, you guys send me auditions, I go, it doesn't matter. Who, what? Like, what do you mean? The girls don't talk to me at school. Can you fix that problem? Like, that's my problem right now. I have no, I'm not sitting here trying to think of what type of actor I can be, and what, watching directors to assuming I can form some sort of ideal film career, you know, from based on my likes and dislikes. None of that was in my purview, and none of that I at all had on my mind. But I think coming off of certain projects gave people that impression. They're like, oh, well, I guess he knows. And I'm like, because he did a little indie drama that where he cried a lot. You know, and I'm like, no clue. You could put me on a commercial set and I'd give you the same answer. Yeah.
Well, Chris, should we let people listen to Robert? This episode
we really should.
So entertaining. This is,
it
I
is.
Had so
Rob
much fun
is
doing this one.
So funny. He's hysterical. You guys are going to love it. We can't wait for you to enjoy it. So without further ado, still performing.
Jesus.
I can't wait for you guys to see AJ's face. Oh, it's going to be so good when you just, it's good. We're going to cut together a montage of AJ reacting to me and we'll just play it. You guys will be playing it on a loop. It's great. He just looks disgusted and embarrassed all the time. Anyway, without further ado, here is Robert Eiler. Hey man, how you doing?
What's up, pal?
What's up, man? Good to hear you. I had all these thoughts of how I could start this conversation with you. And then you and I were texting last week and, you know, I said, hey, if there's anything in general you want to talk about, you know, let me know ahead of time. If there's something specific you want to make sure we touch on. And you said a couple things, but the first thing you said was, you know, we'll talk about how I tried to take your lunch money. and of course, that was the subject that we'll bring up in a bit. But I guess what I wanted to say first is that I had this moment for like a minute of my life where, I don't know if you remember that movie Big Bully with Rick Moranis and Tom Arnold, where, do you guys ever see that movie?
No.
It sounds familiar, but I can't remember.
You'd remember it if you saw some visuals from it. We were all really young when it came out. But in essence, it's this movie where Rick Moranis is this nerdy guy and his high school bully is Tom Arnold. And it, as adults, they run into each other. I've forgotten what setting. And he's the only one in life who knows Tom Arnold is a bully. And he's terrified of the guy. And he's just terrified, but he's an adult. So he has to like be an adult. He's like, oh, I'm over it. And the whole movie's him being like, I'm not scared anymore. I'm over it. You know, like he's a nice guy. We're all adults here. Like there's no threat here. I shouldn't be scared. And then at a certain point, it really turns and Tom Arnold's like super evil and wicked and terrorizes him. And that's the comedy of it. But anyway, I had this like minute of my life where you're like trying to take your lunch money. And there was just this inside reaction where I was like, oh, fuck, man. I just had this, this little bit of fear in me. Where I was like, oh, shit, that shit really doesn't go away. It doesn't matter how long it's been.
That was my daily routine, dude.
Yes, another day in the life.
I got anybody who knew me before the age of like 14 still keeps their money in their sock, you know? Yeah. They got to pretend like, oh, they're like, oh, no, look, here, my pockets are empty. I got nothing.
I can't pay for lunch. Yeah, I told this story then. I'm glad it was just another Tuesday for you. It lingered for me for a long while. And so Rob and I actually did, we filmed an episode of Saturday Night Live when we were kids. And were you on Saturday Night Live a bunch, or was that just like a one weekend thing?
For you? One time.
Just one. Oh, wow. Yeah. So we just happen to work with each other on this weekend. And the way it works, AJ, is you have, you know, you do your rehearsals, you set up for the week, do rehearsals of these skits, and come Friday, if your skit's going to go live on Saturday, then you come back on Saturday, you wait around all day until you do it live on Saturday. So you do this big rehearsal Friday. So you've met people, you've seen people. Rob and I probably spent the week together hanging out. And then come Saturday, we're there all day
long. This is a long day for kids, right? Because it's live at what, 11 o'clock at night?
Yeah. Oh, it's a long day. Yeah. You're not home till like 1 a.m. or so, or 2 a.m. So they've got like the normal dressing room areas and the backstage you see a lot of like the footage of, you know, as you watch Saturday Night Live, these big long hallways and stuff with all these doors in them. But all the extras essentially, and all the like people just have a line here and there, they gather them all and they stuff them on a sound stage that's connected to the whole thing.
You know where Jack stayed in the Titanic?
Yeah.
that's basically where they kept us.
It's the stowaways with the rats. There's no room. And literally they feed you like you're a convict. They literally they give you these little cardboard boxes with like shitty bologna sandwiches, and that's your lunch. I'm not
kidding. But yet you guys are thrilled to be there.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's awesome. And it's going to be this live thing. So it's filled with so much energy. It's super dope. And it's all comedy. You got all these great comedians. So right. I remember, you know, my brothers and I did a bunch of episodes. So we got to work with all kinds of like Steve Martin and Alec Baldwin and Robert Downey Jr. And, you know, and then you got like cool musical acts coming in. So you'll just be sitting there like Smashing Pumpkins is like right there next to you. And so it's a really dope environment. But the shitty part of the environment is that they would stick everybody at the time they were filming the Rosie O'Donnell show. And so they stuck all of us where the audience normally sits in the Rosie O'Donnell talk show. So we all hung out there and you're hanging out all day long. And I have this memory where we're all hanging out. There's like, I don't know, 40, 50 people in the room or so. Rob's already smiling. And he's like, I don't remember, but yeah, for sure. So there was some point, you know, I was like walking around a different part of the Rosie O'Donnell show, away from my mom, away from anybody, it seemed. I don't remember why. I just remember for sure at one point, Rob and like another kid actor or two cornered me. And I don't remember what was said or what happened exactly. All I remember is I was like, oh, for sure, if there weren't people around, I'd get the living shit kicked out of me right now. It's like, all I knew is I was being threatened. I did something weird, which was definitely par for the course for me in my life when I was a kid. And Rob had my number, man. And he absolutely had it. And then I never saw Rob again. I didn't see Rob for years and years.
So you gave him your money?
So no. So no, there wasn't an act. I don't think he demanded any lunch money.
Oh, okay. You know? Just a little confrontation,
just a little confrontation, just flexing his muscles a little bit. Yeah. You know, I literally have no recollection other than me being like, that kid's scary. That kid scares me.
I think what happened was Chris was like, you want to run lines? And we were like, you want to get beat up?
That's exactly how it went. I'm telling you guys, there's this little part of me inside. It's like, oh shit.
Which is every time. It's funny for me to hear, because growing up with you, Chris, in your teenage years, I always knew you to be the tough guy of the crew.
Well, this was going to actually, this is the end to this long story that we're starting with talking to Rob. And I'm really looking forward at some point you talking, Rob. So sorry for grabbing all it. But there was an interesting thing that happened and it ended up, I think, really changing a small part of
this. This is when you started going to Taekwondo, right?
This
after
is
that.
It. Well, no, here's what happened. So then in real life, so years go by, probably 2 years, maybe 3 years. I don't know. Rob and I never saw Rob again. At least I don't remember. But Rob and I then did a movie together. We did The Tick Code. AJ,
the movie that you've mentioned on here
sometimes. So we do The Tick Code and he plays the kid in this movie that bullies me in the thing. And I remember seeing the call sheet and I was like, Robert Eiler's going to be doing this. Fuck, motherfucker. Because I was like, that kid's, he scares me. He's going to terrorize me. And I was all excited to do this movie. And then Rob showed up and Rob was so nice. He was so
what happened,
nice.
Rob?
I wasn't an extra anymore, man.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. And neither was I. I was like the guy in this movie. And I think this is what happened to me inside, is it was the first time in my life I realized that actors had power or could have some power. At least you were protected, you know, because normal life for me is, you know, I was a kid that was, you could target me easy from across the room. You're like, that kid needs to get bullied. Like that made sense. It really did. But on a set, there's a whole new set of rules. There's whole new dynamics. There's a whole new thing. And I literally
ranked by your number on the call sheet.
You totally are. You're ranked by your number and you're just ranked by the safety of, like, as a kid, you're ranked by the safety of being in an adult environment. You know, you're all expected to sit there and behave like adults. So there wasn't going to be room on this thing. You know, nobody was going to shove us in a big soundstage where nobody's watching.
Yeah, all rules are off on the old Rosie O'Donnell set when the lights go out.
Exactly. Yeah. But this became a common theme, I think, for me in my life, separately from Rob, for sure, is that I just realized at a certain point, I was like, oh, I get picked on all the time as on sets. That shit can't fly. Like, this is the one place where I can find a tough guy routine that then spread out, unfortunately, into my normal life where it shouldn't have.
So, Rob, how did you reconcile the tough guy persona with being an artist, entertainer, actor, which usually doesn't have a tough guy persona to it?
Well, you know what happened is, like, when you're an extra, you need to take people's lunch money. When you get on a movie, there's fucking craft service, there's all this stuff. So, like, they were feeding me and it calmed me down a little, you know? But I was when we did that movie, I was probably 5'1" and like 200 pounds.
Wow. Yeah, you were a big kid. Yeah.
Phew. Yeah. Like, there was a scene where they're like, they're in the bathroom stall, like, putting a spell on you, like burning like chicken feet and like sage and all this stuff. And you have to slide under the bathroom door. And the way the guy said it was like, yeah, just slide under the door. I'm like, dude, I'm 200 pounds. Like, you don't just slide under a door when you're 200 pounds, take after take. I'm like, we really got to figure something out. They had to like remove the door off the thing because I was so fat. Just ridiculous.
Do you remember when you think about that stuff? Because you laugh about it so easy now and it seems like such a part of, you know, like, you don't have any qualms with it. But at the time, being 12, is it a lot to go through? Like, are you embarrassed? Are you like, are you really self-conscious of your weight or in moments like that? Because on your podcast, you mentioned there's a scene where you're chasing me down the street. And he said, so like, we did the first take and we have to run a full block in New York and up some staircase. And then, you know, and then I get away from you. And then like, all right, great. And take two. And you're like, motherfucker, take two? Like, you want me to run down this whole street again? And like, in those moments, you remember where they're like, how does that feel?
No, never with acting. I didn't get self-conscious unless it was like with girls, you know, like if it was like, oh, your friend's having a pool party for his birthday. It was like, oh, fuck, you know, because it's like you have to make that choice of like, all right, do I want to be the fat kid in the t-shirt in all the pictures or just the fat kid, you know, like, and the 200 pound wet t-shirt contest look when you're like 12 years old, it's just so bad. Yeah. And like probably the first time I did that. And then after I saw that, I was like, just be fat, dude. You know, like just own it. Because look at when you have that t-shirt like stuck to you in all the pictures, you see like the outline of your belly button and that you're like, this is way more embarrassing than just being fat, you know?
Yeah. I remember the first time I have two little brothers, both of them struggled with their weight most of their lives. And we would go to the beach. We moved to California. We go to the beach. It was like 104 degrees outside and we go straight to the beach and they were like, I'm not taking off the t-shirt no matter what. And they just sit there and sweat. And you're like, just get in the way. They're like, no, I'm not taking it off. I don't care. This is just it. But for you, right, being a young actor, like how much did that affect your, time auditioning or being in front of people or anything? Was there, did that play a role in your experience or a facet of your experience?
Well, that's the thing too. It's like when you're like a kid actor, you go to these auditions and you see like, oh shit, I'm in this room with a bunch of actors and I'm not one, you know? So it's like, it kind of, I realized I was going to have to lean on something to get the roles, whether it was like, oh, he's the fat kid, you know, or like he's the bully or he's the, it's like there were some things where I was like, okay, I have to find my niche because I'm not going to out act 100 kids, you know, like it's just, it's not going to happen. Yet, like, and what you said earlier is like being an actor and like the tough kid and all this stuff. It's like in my head, I wasn't an actor. I was 6 years old. My manager found me on the street and was like, this kid should do commercials. It wasn't like I was a little kid.
Were you shaking somebody down for their money? And they were like, this guy's got
like,
it.
I'm like, you better put me in a fucking show, dude, you know? And he's like, he was just scared. So the kids who would do the school plays in my school, I was like, you fucking nerds, you know? Like, well, why are you doing the school play or like wanting to do anything like that? Like, I was like, what? Unless it was like, you know, we're pretending to shoot a music video and we're like Van Halen or something. Then I'm like, oh, that's cool. But like anything as far as just like even I remember being a kid. And the first time somebody put like Barney on and all, like, who are these losers? Like, you know, like where? And I was so young, but it was just, that's what happened. When you grow up in New York City, I had like uncles who were, you know, 10, maybe 15 years older than me. So I was hanging out with them. And when I was, you know, 10 years old, I thought about things kind of like the 20-year-olds did or the 25-year-olds were like on auditions. Like David Chase even says in the first thing of Sopranos when we shot the first episode, he loved the way that I said fuck. Like that, he's like, that's the thing that got you the line. He's like, all these kids are like, so that's the thing that got you the job anyway. He's like, all these kids, when they said the line, it was like they were really hitting it, you know, and wanting to say, oh, I'm saying a bad word. And he's like, you did it in a way of like, are we fucking done here? You know, like I got other things to do.
It's
like
just that. Part of like, your vocabulary.
Yeah. And he's like, I loved it so much. And he's like, and when we did the pilot, once you did it the way you did in the audition, I, you know, took you aside and I was like, all right, we got that. Like maybe you want to try it this way or another way. And he's like, and you came out and just did it the exact same way that you did it before. You know, he's like, you, and he's like, that's what got you the job though, is that you weren't an actor. You know, like you saw all these kids who were actors. And they're just like, it didn't fit them being the son of a mafia boss because they were like these little actors, yeah, you know, little, like
that sensitive and probably doing musical theater in between auditions and stuff. And like,
how did you maintain being a non-actor for so long? If your manager found you at six and you didn't start The Sopranos until you were maybe what, 12, 13, 14, something like that?
Yeah, we filmed the pilot when I was 12. I think it was because I didn't have any friends who were actors. Not a single one. The only friends that I do now is like people from Sopranos, you know, Chris when I'm not bullying him. But besides that, it's like, but it really was like I never, and even after I got Sopranos, when I was 13, 14, 15, 16, like I was hanging out in the park with kids my age. There were no 14, 15-year-olds who were like, oh man, yeah, I go home every Sunday night and watch Sopranos at HBO at 9 p.m. You know, yeah, so it was like, right. I was just another kid. And then sometimes it was like, if we were around adults, you know, like sometimes we'd go to a diner or something like this to like get, and there was somebody would be like, oh yeah, Sopranos, it. But like people my age, they didn't give a shit.
Really? Nobody at school? What did, I always wondered that with a show like Sopranos and being a part of that and living in New York and being a part of New York, that became such a zeitgeist cultural moment, that TV show. And was there ever a point that it's at some point where it really played a role in your life? Like, did you suddenly, I always wonder if you became like Michael Rapaport and Spike Lee, you know, where it's like all of a sudden you're part of the fabric of the culture of New York because you're a very recognizable face on a show that screams New York City.
Yeah.
Did that change at some point or did it always feel like you had a like a double life almost?
No. So when I was 16, I got arrested and that was when my family kind of pulled me aside and was like, you can't do what you're doing anymore. Like you can't go every night to the park and like drink 40s and smoke weed. Like it's not cool. You have something that we all want, you know? And like even people in my neighborhood would be like, yo, you could get it out of here. Like not that, I mean, New York City is kind of like one block away. There's like millionaires. And then in your building, it's like you're broke. So it's weird to be like my neighborhood, you know, but that's what it was like. It was like people are like, dude, you're going to blow this. I was on the front cover of the paper in like handcuffs, you know? So I had people coming up to me, everyone just giving me their 2 cents. Like, you can't be doing this. You can't be doing this. So it was hard, but
you're like the Matt Damon of your neighborhood. You were like the Good Will Hunting.
Like, well, it does scream of double life though, because you are this professional doing a very professional job, but you're also keeping it real with your friends after hours or when on non-shooting days and hanging out, like you said, hanging out in the park? And how did you balance those two things? Or like, how could they occupy equal space in your brain?
Well, my family was never like the type of people who are like, you want to get a job that you're passionate about and go do it. And if you work, you'll never work a day in your life. It was like, work was something you did to pay the bills and then that's it. You leave it there and that's one of the things I'm most grateful for with Sopranos is like getting to be around the best actors in the world, some of the best, everywhere, those directors, writers, the camera people, the lighting people. And you're like, oh shit, these people are like unbelievable at their craft and they work their way up and through hard work, they're here now. And like, because my family kind of, I was super poor growing up and I remember them telling us like, no, rich people, like it's all fixed, like rich people didn't get rich because they worked hard. Rich people are rich because they're, that's how it is. There's the poor people and then there's the rich people. So I remember like, when Kevin Durant got the MVP of the NBA and he's like, my mom always said like, you could do anything you put your mind to. I'm like, what? Like, who's giving those speeches to little kids? Like, I remember like being told like, hey, if you're lucky, you'll get your grandfather's job. Like, if you don't screw up.
So, sorry to cut you off. Your family's like super working class. And like, what do your parents do?
Yeah. So my dad's an engineer at a mall in Queens and my mom works for transit. But before that, like my parents had me when they were super young, like still in high school. So there were no careers. Like, it was just kind of like my grandfather was the super of a building. So we got to live in our apartment for free. And then my grandmother worked at a school. So we lived with them until, my mom and dad got older and then my parents were never really together. It's a real beautiful story.
It's a beautiful story. But at some point in this story, some guy walks up blindly to you and your mom or dad on the street and says, I think this kid needs to get a headshot and become a professional actor and get into showbiz. And do they just jump at it? Like, do you remember, have they told you how that whole all goes down or?
Yeah. So my dad, like the guy was a gay guy and this is like 1991. And my dad's like a, bench pressing, motorcycle riding kind of dude. And like, he was kind of like, excuse me, and he's like, oh, your son should give him his car. He gave him the card and he's like, your son should be an actor. Like, I think he said I should be a model too, but he didn't realize I wasn't going to grow anymore from the age of six. So my mom was like, okay, yeah. And we started going on commercials. I just started booking shit. Like I booked like all national, like Pizza Hut, AT&T, IBM. And the guy who was my manager then is still my manager now, 30 years later.
That's wild. The guy that found you.
Yeah. And the crazy part was when I was like 9 years old, things were kind of crazy in my family and my grandmother passed away and I broke my arm and all this tragic shit was happening. So my mom's like, we don't have time to do this fucking auditioning bullshit, like, or people in my family, whoever, they were like, yeah, there's no time for this, like going into these rooms and playing pretend, And I'm like, okay, so we got out of it. And then every couple months, the guy would call and he'd be like, you got to bring him back. You got to get him back in. And my parents were just like, it's too much. Like we have to work now trying to find somebody to take him and this. So they finally, after he kept calling, they were like, all right, we'll get him back in. And shortly after that, I got Sopranos.
No shit.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so funny to me because that feels, I mean, obviously Sopranos feels like such a meaningful part of your life and a part of, you coming into adulthood and that it stays with you, it seems, even till now. But for you to get there to that opportunity feels like it's hanging by a thread, it's just like they don't answer the phone that week or they're having a bad week or your family's going through something and they decide we're not going to take them to that audition, I have two questions. One is like, how much of it was really conscious for you? Like, were you sitting there understanding a lot of how you were feeling and what was going on? Or did you sort of feel like it was just stuff was over your head and you're rolling with the punches and you're just there?
My first ever like self-reflection was done at like 28 years old. So I never knew anything I never knew what I was feeling of this. I just thought like, yeah, man, this is what you do. Like, okay, I'm getting off work. My friends are calling me, you go to the park I definitely wasn't thinking about any of it. It's weird, but I realized, shortly after being there, which was like, oh, I did realize like, I'm not an actor. I need to be able to do everything else perfectly. meaning like I'm never going to show up and not know my lines, because if you can't act and you don't know your lines, you're gone. You know, like you're what are you here for? You know, so it was just like things like that, and always being super respectful. But it was even like I remember there were times where I would act a certain way, like, you know, beyond respectful, where like, you know, going backwards to take a picture with somebody when you didn't even have to, or like there were things that we would do sometimes where it was like a DVD signing, you know, and there would be, or whatever they had then, VHS even, and we'd go and there would be a line of people, like 300 people or whatever, and at 250 they'd be like, all right, it's too crazy, like we have to cut them off and this, and like afterwards I'd be like, okay, I'm going to go to those people, you know, and make sure I sign for everybody for this, because it was like, I felt like I had to bring something more, because you see like Edie Falco and James Gandolfini and you see these people and you're like, holy shit, like they are, it's so next level. Like, I'm like, I don't even see actors like this in the movies I watch, you know, yeah, like they're so good. So it definitely, I did reflect on like, I have to do more, you know, I can't just show up and do my job. And the reason why, what I was saying is the reason why I did all those things was like, it was not like, I want those people to think I'm a good person. It's like, I never wanted any sort of like bad association with the show. Like I never wanted somebody to be like, yeah, you know, I met AJ, he didn't take a picture with me. You know, I met AJ Sperano, he didn't take a picture with me. Cause then it's like, well, that's the shit I gotta be doing, you know, like I gotta be out there fucking shaking hands and kissing babies, because I'm not gonna out act anyone on this set, you know.
I was about to say, it's funny because it is like a political, you're like, you took the politician route with you're like, yeah, I'm gonna be good at this facet of the acting game because the other stuff's intense. I've never felt like that's my lane, or that's, you know, that's what I even want to be doing.
But you wanted to be there though, Robert. Like, even though acting seemingly fell in your lap when you got this job, you wanted to be on the set. You wanted to be doing the acting thing at that point.
Yeah. Well, I realized when I was like 15, 16, somewhere in there, I'm like, man, you know, like acting is my passion and I'm so passionate about it and this. And then when I was 22, finished Sopranos and went to act on other things, I was like, oh, acting was not my passion. Like the Sopranos was my passion, you know, doing it
right
on that show with those people, having that family and the way everyone treated each other and how respectful everyone was and what it just meant to my family and every, you know, like everything about it was just so perfect. That then when I went to do other stuff and it was like everybody showed up on set and they said cut and everybody like went back to their trailers and just kind of did their own thing. And I was like, oh, this isn't what I loved, you know. But it's, you can't find something like that in you know, showing up on one episode doing something or something you're not going to get when you had it for 10 years, you know.
I can so relate to that. Not that I ever had 10 years on something, but the difference of feeling like you belong to a community, you belong to a tribe, and everyone's participating and supporting each other versus, like you said, showing up for a guest star doing a couple of days and nobody cares that you're there. Doesn't matter.
Or a movie where you're filming for a month and then you're done. Yeah,
everyone's gone. Yeah.
And you did, like, you got spoiled. I mean, you know, I think that like there are career actors that are so respected and lauded and recognized and have had amazing bodies of work that haven't been able to be a part of something like that.
And so, Robert, when the manager calls your family back and is pushing and saying, you got to put him back in there, like figure whatever you got to figure it out. You got to get Robert back in auditioning again. And ultimately your mom or your parents decide that, okay, we're going to send Robert out again. What was your feeling about that? Were you like, this is great, I'm so glad to be auditioning? Or did you not really care one way or the other?
Yeah, I didn't really care. Like, I remember getting Sopranos and being really upset because first we got the call that we got the TV show. And then instantly everybody in my family is like, you're going to be on TV. You're going to be famous. Like you're going to be on this huge TV show. It's going to be unbelievable, blah, blah, blah. And then I'm like, okay, we go to shoot the first episode and Tony Sirico, who played Paulie Walnuts, I'm like, oh man, like, you know, we're on a TV show, huh? And he's like, listen, kid, we do these all the time. Like, we'll never see each other again. And I just remember being so shot down. And I was like, oh my God, we're not going to see each other again. And I remember that was the first year I was going to go away to summer camp. And I was fine with not going to summer camp because I thought I was going to be on this big TV show. And then once he said, like, no, this isn't going to be anything, we'll never see each other again, I was like, I remember walking around the entire pilot while we were filming, I was like, I could be in summer camp. You know, like, this is such bullshit. And I was pissed. And I think Jamie actually might have like had kind of the same thing where like she was, you know, 16, she's supposed to be going to summer camp this and she got the show. And but she was, I think we both, because me and her are the only two people on the show who are not Italian. you know? So we both kind of had the same thing at the audition, which is like, this is probably a waste of time for us, you know? Mm. And that's how we felt. And somehow we were the two who got in, the only two people who were not Italian on the show. It's pretty crazy.
So do you mind me asking, just sort of pre-Sopranos, you're doing all these commercials, you're doing Pizza Hut commercials, you're doing everything. And for you being like in your head, at least going like, I don't want to be doing this. I'm not an actor. Were you ever asked to do something or had to do something that you were like, fuck, like did anybody ever try to put you in a leotard and you were like, I'm going to tear somebody's head off. I can't do this, you know? Or did you ever say no, you know?
like I was saying with on Sopranos, it was like, I have to say yes to what, you know, if they're like, hey, it's 6 a.m. and you're eating dumplings all day. It's like, okay, cool. You know, I'm like, I know there's no fucking Chinese places open at 6 a.m. So this is old and microwaved and at 6 a.m. And I'm like, bring on the dumplings, you know, like that's what you got to do. And I remember there was once, the only time I ever said no to anything, there was a scene where they wanted me to be in a Speedo for like the swim team. And I was like, nope, absolutely not.
I would have drawn the line there too. I would have done the same thing.
Yeah. Right. And I was, you know, much heavier then. And I still wouldn't do it. But then it's like, oh my God. And yeah, I remember telling them no. And they were like, okay, well, here's what we're thinking. What if we, and I was like, no. Like, they were like, what if you just, if we have someone holding a towel around you? And I'm like, no, like I'm not wearing an all Speedo. Like I was, you know, I was the palest, fattest. I was like, no, there's just, I refuse to do it. You know, if this is how I lose the job, if I got to go to take my grandpa's job, I'll do it, man. I'm not getting the Speedo.
Do you remember what the compromise was?
I could be a movie star or I could be a super of a building, and I don't care if that Speedo, I'm not Speedo, doing it.
I'm going back to my apartment building.
The compromise was I did not put on the Speedo.
Yeah, that's it.
I love that you have principles. You draw the line someplace. You're willing to do a lot for your job, but you will not.
Was there anything you remember, even like just auditioning as a young actor when you're doing all those commercials? Was there something like?
No, I never remember them asking me to do weird shit. But the one thing I remember was I did a Toys R Us audition and I got a call back and they're like, oh, you know, they love him. He's perfect for it. They just want him to do like a couple of other things. Blah, blah, blah. My mom's like, okay. So she brings me on the, and I don't know how old I am. Let's say 7 years old or something. And she brings me on the audition and they want me to sing like, I don't want to grow up. I'm a Toys R Us kid. And they said, okay, and action. And I sang White Wedding instead. So every single time they were like, and action. And I'm like, hey, little sister, what have you done? And they like the first two or three takes, these people love it. They're like, oh my God, this is so funny. This is so cute. This is-. And then by take like four or five or six, they're like, listen, if you don't sing the Toys R Us song, you're not going to get the fucking job. And I was like, hey, little sister, shotgun, you know? And then, so my mom, you know, they told my mom, like, if you can get him to sing this song, like, you can book the job. And she just couldn't do it. And she said the whole ride home, all I was doing was singing the Toys R Us song.
That's so funny. That is that. I mean, that's just inbuilt in you. That's just who you are. So there was no controlling you, regardless. Even if your own mom is going, "Hey, man, you got to try to do this. Can you please just sing the song?" There's no way you're doing it.
Yeah,
and that's just the approach.
Yeah.
There's something about the Sopranos set, though, that seems like it made you shape up. Like you were the consummate professional, it sounds like, on that set.
Well, that was like once the money started coming in, you know, like once you see like real deal fucking checks, and it was like, oh, this is like life changing. And it was also, I was in the world, like living my life. And I saw like there were fucking billboards in Times Square with my face on it. It was like, holy shit, this is not just like some little thing. And I also really did love the fact that it wasn't one of those things where like, I went to school and kids were like, oh my God, like you're on the set. Like there was no talk of it. You know, it was like this thing that I did. It was like, I was fucking moonlighting as an actor, you know, like I would go and I would do this thing and it was super. And you know, they never treated me like the kid who didn't know how to act. You know, they were just like, they were all so great to me and so respectful and cool that it was just, I think like I was just giving what I got, you know, the professionalism, how amazing they were. And then top it off with like, hey, this is this TV show, you know, like when they talk about how popular the TV show was, like in my own eyes, I had only seen, you know, things like, maybe Seinfeld and stuff like that, where it was like, oh, everyone knows the deal with even like, I don't know. I just knew like, you can't fuck this up. That was the feeling I really hold on to with it, was like, don't fuck this up. This could change your life, you know?
And you just mentioned too, like your life did change. For sure you noticed financially, you know, when you talk about your family life and where you come from, then all of a sudden you're getting these big checks and I mean, my guess is, correct me if I'm wrong, you're making way more money than your parents do. And you're still a kid and you're aware of it. Walk us through that a little bit. Like, were you able to spend your own money? Did you like what was your relationship like that to your money at that age?
I don't remember having access to any of my money until I was 18, you know? So maybe at like 17 or 16, I had a little bit or whatever, but like, you know, I remember being 15 years old and being in the park with my friends and being like, all right, how do we each come up with $7, the three of us, so we can get a 20 bag of weed and like a dollar for the blunt. And it was just her, you know, dollar for two blunts or whatever. And it was just always trying to like being at the park and being like, man, I wish you can go get another 40. And it was like, oh, well. And like, people are like, dude, you're on TV. Like, yeah, what do you, exactly. You know? And it was just like, yeah, but it's funny because when you talked about like, when does that transition come of like feeling like you're in the fabric of New York City and you're actually in show business, was like, I was 17 years old and Jamie Lynn had a birthday party at this nightclub. And she's like, oh, if you want to come by. I'm like, you sure? I'm 17. Are they going to let me? She's like, yeah, don't worry. They'll let you in, you know? So I go and I went by myself and I met the owner and he's like, dude, anytime you ever want to come back. He's like, just let me. So the next night I showed up with like six 16 year olds who all had like rips in their shirt, and not because it was cool, you know, like they literally like my one friend had, I'll never forget, he had a hat on it with like the head of a goat and it was like bleeding, and he put a nail through the top of his hat just because like he thought it looked cool. So there's like six of us rolling up, and
that kid didn't make it for sure. He's not around, unfortunately.
So he had the guy open up the rope for the nightclub, and the six of us walked in, and he stopped me at the end and he goes, don't ever do this again. And I was like, don't ever come again? And he's like, no, don't ever bring six guys. So, and I didn't know protocol, you know. Now obviously it's like, holy shit, I can't believe you let me in. But it's he's like, yeah, you come with one friend, you know, and you have a good time or whatever. So from that night on, every single night I called one of my friends. I'm like, yo, you want to go to the I won't say the name of the place because I was 17, obviously, but it was every single night. And I don't want to give numbers or anything, but I started to, you know, there were girls there who were, you know, excited older. That, yeah, older. Yeah. And it was like, oh, this guy's on. And I had only been with like the girl I lost my virginity to at the time, maybe. And it just opened up this new door to like, holy shit. Like that was when I really remember. It was like, wow, things are really changing. Because, you know, when I was 16 and we were hanging out, we were like all dudes, you know, like if there were 30 of us, it was like 28 dudes, you know, and then like the two chicks who were like the boys, you know, and then all of a sudden you go to this nightclub where these girls are half naked, everybody's drinking, you're having a good time. And all of a sudden it's just like some girl corners you in the bathroom, starts making out, and you're like, I can come here every day. Like, yeah, it's like there's everything I like. This guy just opened up the door to everything I want in life, you know? And I just, from the time I was 17 until the time I was, I don't know, like, you know, 22, 23, I was out every night, mostly doing cocaine, staying up for days, partying, and just have it like, to bring it back to Sopranos. When I was on Sopranos, when I was 22, there was a scene where I'm like contemplating suicide, and because my girlfriend broke up with me, everything. And Terry Winter was the writer, who's unbelievable. And I think he was directing that episode. And he comes up to me and I'm sitting on the bed in the scene. I'm thinking about suicide, everything. And he comes and he sits with me and he's like, you know, he's setting the mood for the scene. He's like, you know, when you're just contemplating your existence and you're just sitting there in your room and you're just going, why the fuck are we here? Why am I here? Is this all pointless? And I looked at him and I went, no. Yeah. I was like, what are you talking about, dude? I was like, I'm on the fucking greatest TV show. We're getting paid a bunch of money. Girls,
you know what
now.
I did last night? I was in a Speedo in the booth. Totally fine.
Yeah. And I'm like, dude, I'm sorry. I don't know what you're talking about. And he just kind of like shook his head and bullied yes and like walked away and was like, I get it. You know, like I just hadn't because I was like, this is insane, you know? And then, you know, now at 28, I decided to get sober, and it's been, you know, 7-8 years now, and it's just a whole new life. But back then, you know, there are times where I'll talk to a friend who I haven't spoken to in 10 years, you know, randomly will call me and we talk, and like I find myself pacing around my apartment telling these stories, and we're just like, holy shit, man, do you remember the time like we were in Manhattan and got a phone call and we just got on a flight to Miami and didn't know where we were going because we'd never been to Miami, and blah, blah, blah. And it's just like all this crazy shit where now I'm like, I just want, you know, when girls are dating a guy and they're like, man, it's never a dull moment with him. It's like, I just want my life to be all dull moments. You know?
Like, I'm like, browse Trader Joe's and pick out something nice for dinner. And that's
exactly. I'm like, you know, there's 8 grams of sugar in there. Like the serving size is pretty big for that.
That's funny.
When you turned 18, and you got access to your money, did the floodgates just open? Did you just go hog wild, or did you have any restraint there?
No, not at all. Like I wasn't at all. You know, I moved out the day I turned 18. So in my head, I was like, wow, I'm spending a lot of money out of nowhere. Like now I'm paying for my own rent and this, but it was like, if there was a camera in my apartment from when I turned 18, it was like my friends and family helped me move in. I was hungover. We put all the stuff in the apartment, and for 1 year, nothing moved. Like it was just, there was a clear path to the couch and like a clear path to the bed. And then every day I would wake up, I'd call some of my friends, like, yo, you want to come over and smoke or whatever, start smoking, order some food, we'd eat, and then just start drinking. And it was like, if there was a camera in that apartment, you'd be like, there's no way this is 9 months later, because it's the same exact day. And 9 months, I lived in that apartment for a year and I slept on my couch every night. And what the hell are you?
I have such a similar experience. I moved into Hollywood. I like knew these actors. They got me this apartment and like the Hollywood Tower, which was this like awesome, dope old building. And I go in there and like, I'd never had anything in my life. Like I'd gone to the mall to buy some posters, you know, it's like about the extent of me knowing how to spend money or have my own space, you know? And the same thing, my buddy gave me a couch. He's like, I got a couch in storage. And I was like, you have two couches and one you don't use? Sure. And I slept on the couch for like 6 months. And they're like, get a bed. I was like, oh, you're right. I should get a bed. I had two bedrooms in this apartment, you know? But I really, same thing. All I did was party. And all I did was like, we were in Hollywood. We just walked to clubs. And I noticed that being an actor got us in places. And I was like, holy, like, I remember waiting in lines, you know, for like an hour, and then we go to a club or a bar, and then a month later we'd go again, and the person there was like, oh, hey guys, and it would notice me or a friend of mine, and then we were in, and I was like, why the fuck did we wait an hour last time?
You know? Sometimes Chris would pose it as his own publicist.
Oh, yeah.
We would have Chris call the club ahead of time as his publicist.
That's
and
when
tell
we got
that
real.
We were all going.
That's when we became full professionals and we were just full club sluts as we would start. We're like, oh, we don't even want to wait to get recognized at the door. I would just call up as a fake publicist and be like, so and so and so and so are celebrating their birthdays tonight. You may know them from movies with so and so and so and so. And look, yeah, I know it's last minute, but I'm on a real tight schedule here and I just pretend to be this overworked intern that needed to get these actors into the club. And it worked every time. We were like, we were in. It was great.
And at the same time, you're practicing your craft.
It's exactly it. I was like, beautiful. I'm pretty good at this shit. I'm pretty good at lying and pretending. I was wondering when you talked to, I had two things I want to touch on. Is you said you were 16 when you got arrested. And we realized like you're the first former kid actor we're going to talk to that does have a mugshot and that has made it like onto the internet and has become part of your life. It isn't, you know, it isn't hidden. It's not something nobody knows about. And so I want to touch on that. And then I also want to touch on what you mentioned too of like, you know, it's so funny to hear you say like, you know, you showed up to the Sopranos, you were willing to stay there and sign an extra 50 autographs for some fans. But then every single night of your life, you're walking into clubs, you know, like using any drug it sounds like you can find and drinking and hanging out. And like, what is that whole, you know, did you ever not show up to set on time? Were you ever talked to, like, did it affect your professional life at a certain point? I just kind of want you to talk about both things if that's cool.
Yeah. Zero. Never affected me at all. Except there were 2 days where I worked. One time, so at my 21st birthday, this nightclub in Vegas called Tao flew out like 10 or 20 of my, I don't even remember how many, 20 of my friends, put everybody in rooms. Like they told us, like, you never have to leave this building. Like, we got everything you need.
You're here.
And I loved gambling, and because I used to drive like 5 hours upstate in New York to go to this place where you only get to be 19. And this was the first time where I could legally gamble. And I remember being like, I'm going to take out $5,000 and put it on red. Like right when we get there, all my best friends and we're drinking and we're partying. So I put $5,000 on red, and insane. Like, this is straight out of a movie. It came red 21. And it was like gink, gada, bink, 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 red 21. And they had $10,000 in front of me. And I'm like, that's the most money I've ever seen. Like, I'm bugging out. I'm like, oh my God. So now all my friends around me, we just got off the plane. I'm like, we let it ride. And then, so they're like, all right. Like, the lady spins the thing. It's like, bink, bada, bink, bink, red. Like $20,000. I'm like, oh my God. This is where the addict comes in. I'm like, we let it ride, you know? Like, and I was like, bink, gada, dink, dink. It was like, you know, 13 black. And the lady just scooped the $20,000 back into like this black hole. And I remember my heart dropping. And I was like, oh my God, that went from like, we could have the best weekend ever to now I have to borrow money from my friend. I don't have a fucking dollar on me. But so when we went that weekend, when I came home, I got home on a Monday. And on Tuesday, I had to work. And when I showed up, I was just good for nothing. Like, I had no voice. I showed up, you know, I was there. And they actually had a
PA. I know my lines. I can't speak them out loud, but I know.
Right. I always know them, baby. And there was actually a PA who was following me around with a garbage can because I was just throwing up like all the time. Like, I would take a sip of water and throw up. I mean, it was Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And I just partied the entire time in Vegas. Like, it was disgusting. Disgusting. And so that time, and then there was another time where we were shooting a wedding scene in Long Island, I think. And what happens is, you know, there's 250 people in the scene, and I'm at a table somewhere in the back, you know, so it's like the camera's not on me, it's all good, whatever. And these people came by the set and they said, hey, I know you guys are staying at the hotel over here. If you want to come to our bar afterwards, we'll shut it down just for you guys. That's all you got to tell me. Like, I'm going around talking to extras, you know, I'm like, hey, you know, we got a bar fucking right around the way. And so I don't know. It's like whatever time we wrap, midnight, and we go to this bar. And now like the guy's like, you want to get behind the bar and bartend? I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? So every shot I made for everyone, I would take a shot with them, you know? And I definitely had some drugs and I'm fucking partying this. Next thing I know, it's like 6 a.m., the sun's coming up. And I think we had like a, you know, 10 a.m. call time, whatever it was, 9 a.m. call time. And we go back to the hotel. I fall asleep. And there's a guy, Jeff Marchetti, who worked on our set, who was like the jack of all trades. Like he was a fixer, you know, like he made things all right. And he was really a set dresser, but he would just do everything. And all of a sudden he's in my room screaming at me and I'm laying there naked. And he's like, what the fuck? He's like, what the fuck is your problem? Da, da, da. I'm like, what? He's like, it's noon and you're not on set. And you were supposed, I think, let's say the call time was 10. He's like, you're supposed to be 10 o'clock. I'm like, oh my God, why? So Michael Imperioli was staying in the room next to me, who played Christopher on Sopranos. And he's gone and in set, and we're going to share a car together. So I get ready in 30 seconds. I hop in his car, Jeff Marchetti's car. He drives me to set. The PA sees me. She's like, luckily the cameras turn the other way. Like, they don't even know you're not here. And I'm like, oh my God, thank God. So I run in on set, and I'm, you know, however old now, 22. And like, I'm one of the guys. I'm not the kid anymore. And I see Imperioli and I go, hey man, I go, thanks for waking me up. You know, I'm like, you could have at least, and he's like, are you kidding me? I go, what do you mean? He goes, I got into your room and I was yelling at you, come on, like we got to go. And he's like, and you had your eyes still closed. You raised your arm as if you had a remote in it and were just pretending to push a remote, thinking that like you were trying to shut me off. Like, I don't know if you thought I was on the TV or like whatever. And he's like, after not being able to wake you up for however long, he's like, I just left. Oh, yeah. Well, actually, thanks. You know, he really tried.
So that's so funny. Also, every set has a fixer. That's what I've realized in my life. It's like every set has a Jeff Marchetti. I wonder then, obviously, like it begs the question, like then obviously people knew. Obviously people knew that you're partying hard, and obviously people knew that occasionally it can affect your ability to show up and stuff. Did anybody ever pull you to the side? Did anybody ever call your manager or your parent? Like did it ever extend past those moments where there, you know, where someone was saying, yo, man, what are you doing? Or
never about partying, but there was, you know, I forget if I found out after James passed or if my manager told me when he was still alive, but he told me like James Gandolfini would call my manager and ask like, you know, is he hanging out with the right people? Is he, how hard is he, what is he paying for rent? Like, is he blowing his money? Is he being an idiot? Is he doing that? And he told my manager, like, don't ever tell Robert that I'm calling you and making these phone calls. And, you know, Jim was always there for me because I remember there was a story one time that somebody told of like, I forget, I was like 18 years old and it was like, yeah, Rob went to this poker place and lost like $20,000 and got into a fight with somebody in this. And I was like, dude, I was like, that's a total lie. But somebody had heard it on set and they told James before they told me. And I told James, I'm like, listen, the most money I've ever played poker with is like $1,000 in my life. And the places I've gone to, like, we get along, like, you know, it's all good. There's no problem. Yeah. So he, you know, he came to me when he thought there might've been a problem with me gambling, but I told him, I'm like, no, because I never had a problem gambling. You know, I told him, you know, everything was fine. I explained it to him and he just, you know, he was always super supportive, always like, hey, if you need anything, you know, come to me, talk to me. And I think they all took the right approach, you know, because I was never the guy who was like falling down and, you know, insane. And luckily, like when I went to nightclubs, there's this thing. I mean, maybe in LA it's different, but in New York, it was very like in New York, the guys who own the nightclubs let in the people who write the stories. So it was like, hey, if you want these stories about you or that we could make it happen, or if you're one of these people who maybe you went there once and you were an asshole, like, yeah, there's going to be a story it'll come out about you. But I would go to the same places because I was 17. I'm like, I can't get in everywhere. You know, I gotta go be loyal to my guys. And I remember like, you know, one of the first year of me going out, some story came out about me and I go to my boy. I'm like, what the fuck is this? Blah, blah, blah. And he's like, oh, you don't like publicity. Like it was a really positive, like, you know, Robert Eiler seen on a couch with 20 girls around him for this model's birthday party. And then it was, and I was like, no, dude, I don't care if you think it makes me look cool. I'm like, I don't want my name mentioned in anything about partying or going out. And just like that, that was it. Like, cause like I said, the guys who write for those things want to get let into clubs and the owners are the ones who say if they can get into clubs or not. So they would tell them like, hey, that guy, and that girl want publicity. These guys don't ever want to be mentioned. And that group over there, we don't know, you know, so write whatever you want about them. But it was, I was lucky to have made friends with the right people there and nothing. But it was also like the only story would be like, man, his jaw was really flying last night. You know, like there weren't, things weren't too crazy. It was just like, you know, I was definitely, it's funny because when I tell some of my partying stories, like some people are like, that sounds unbelievable. And I'm like, you don't understand when your job is to party, how good you can really become at it. Because, you know, I used to party for 3 days straight and people were like, there were a lot of that was drugs, but then there were times where I would just be drinking alcohol and I would start drinking Saturday night and still be going Monday. And my friends would be like, how are you still going right now? And it's like, well, because last week when I did this and I was hungover, I slept for 30 hours straight, you know? So I'm like, I'm good. Like I'm
17 I'll balance years, this out.
Right. Yeah. I'm like, I'm 17 years old. I just slept for 30 hours. Like I'm ready to party, man. You know, I had no, besides when Sopranos, when we would stop Sopranos, I would have 9 months or a year just to chill. And it was like, I'm like, what am I going to do except become like a professional fucking loser, you know, and just party. And it was also like when I'd be working, I would always have everybody telling me like, the story's them partying and this. And I was always a guy who was like, when I'm working, I'm not partying. You know, like it's just, if I had to shoot on Friday, I wouldn't go out on Monday. You know, I wouldn't go out on Tuesday. Like I knew, I was like, I can't be, again, it was one of those things where like, I'm not talented enough to be like, hey, Rob didn't show up today. You know, like he's just, we don't know where he is. Blah, blah, blah. Like I couldn't pull that shit, you know? So I was like, I'm not going to drink for like a week before whenever I have to work. So when I would have all my friends telling me about these great stories and these parties and this, as soon as they'd be like, all right, you got 9 months off. I was like, I'm not doing anything but party.
Yeah, I get you. And so it's just those rare couple of circumstances then it sounds like, you know, where you go off to Vegas where, you know,
somebody walks up to you, they say that there's an open bar, you guys can take it over.
Yeah, exactly.
It might happen.
So those things, but the rest of the time you sort of curb that life to show up professionally. As I sit there and listen to it, I wonder, like, it made me think of like the Last Dance documentary where like at a certain point, Dennis Rodman is popping off to Vegas and everybody knows. And, you know, and those like, you're like, he's allowed to get away with a little bit of stuff and he's allowed to occasionally miss some practices or do something. And you can tell that people are letting him know they see it, but they're not like reprimanding them. They're not demanding he's change or anything like that. But I wonder, like, have you ever looked back as an adult and ever thought they should have acted different since you're a kid, since you're 18 or 19, or you don't?
For sure. And like I said, when you're partying for 36, 48, 72 hours, that first like 8 hours, I could pass any sobriety test in the world. So like, it was never like they saw me and were like, whoa, he's getting out of control, because, you know, we never partied for more than like 8 hours, you know, it was like we would have the Christmas party or the Emmys and this. And it wasn't like after the Emmys at, you know, noon the next day, everybody was still partying with me, you know, that they were done and I would go on and do my own thing. You know, I think that they all handled it great and they never really saw me out of, cause like, when I show up for my 21st birthday from Vegas with no voice, they're like, ah, you know, like, to be expected, you know, that kind of thing. Like the only other time where I was out of line was, again, there were 250 people in the scene and like nobody knew that I was late or anything. So, you know, I don't think there was anybody who ever stayed around late enough to see me out of control who, you know, not that there was anyone out of control, but they... anybody who would see me at my state also liked to hang out, you know, like they weren't going to be like, hey, maybe you should do this. But also like, you know, when I was on the show and it was 17, 18, 19, I don't think even then, if you told me like, hey, you have a problem, I'd be like, no, I don't. Like I show up to work, I do my thing, I don't spend my money, I go out, I have a good time. Nothing was like too out of control then. It wasn't until later where like I was like, oh wait, I'm not having fun anymore. Like, you know, this is just this like vicious cycle of partying, and then it's like, oh, if I don't take painkillers, I don't want to get out of bed. Like, you know, like that's not fun. And there are some drugs like ecstasy where it's like, hey everyone, I'm doing ecstasy. And then there's drugs like painkillers where it's like nobody knew I was taking fucking 15 painkillers a day. You know, even my best friend, like I wouldn't be like, yo, like this is, you know, I wasn't telling him like, hey, I'm going to buy fucking 300 Percocets behind this casino and it's kind of shady. And it, like, I would just, you're just doing it, you know, you're just doing these things. And
I have a question about it because, you know, there's this, like, we've talked a lot on this podcast about the common joke and stigma of the former kid actors that they are like a drug addict recluse waiting to happen, that they're ready to like burn it down at some point and become like desperate for fame and desperate for something. And, you know, and like, that's the story that everybody tells, or at least pays the most attention to. And I've always felt like those problems would exist in someone, whether they were a former kid actor or not, you know, but that their life as an actor can definitely influence, sometimes good and sometimes bad ways, you know, how someone's maybe struggles with addiction or alcoholism go. And so for you, do you feel like if someone were to think, oh, hey, well, yeah, here's this young kid actor who's given all this money, so of course he's a drug addict. Like, you know, I don't think, excuse me, that's necessarily true, you know, but I wonder for you, like, do you feel like your life as a kid actor did have a bearing on that in any shape or form, or what part of it did it play? What did it affect that part of your life?
For sure, I could say the only reason I stopped doing drugs and alcohol was because I was an actor and had a great opportunity in life and was, you know, had financially and had good friends and had this. But like, I definitely would have been involved in drugs and alcohol and all that. I don't know to what extent, because I have friends who went both ways where it was like I had friends who like drugs as much as I did, but they would be like, all right, man, it's 2:30 in the morning. Like I gotta go. I'm done. I got work on Monday or whatever. I had those friends. And then I had friends who were like, yeah, I got fired because last Wednesday, like we partied until Saturday. And then I did, you know? So I was like, I don't know which one of those I would have ended up being. I would imagine I would have been the out of control person, but there's also like, The only way I feel like it really assists was like, I got so much for free, you know, it was like, I have a lot of friends who are like, yeah, well, I can't do coke for 3 days, you know, because nobody will give it to me for three, like, and I don't have the money. I don't have a job. I don't have this. So like, yeah, did it happen like once a year for them? Sure. They would do it. Or like, oh, we're like, we're saving up because my birthday and this. But for me, it was like any night I went out, people, especially after I got arrested and had weed on me, like people would just come up and give me like a handshake with bags of drugs in my hand. You know, so it was like, fuck it, let's go, like let's party or whatever. But I do know when I had my last crazy partying, which was just like so out of control, my 28th birthday, when I went to the doctor and he kind of talked to me and laid it out for me of like, well, you can keep going and this is what's going to happen, or you can get clean and this is what's going to happen. I remember being like, man, I'm really blowing this, you know, like I had, out of all the kids that I brought to the Sopranos premieres, four of them have died already, you know, from fucking drugs. And this, so it's like, it's, I just look at that and I'm like, man, that could, that's that, not that it should be me, but like that could so easy, it could have just been one, you know, I was with that guy a month ago before he, like, who knows if I would have been doing that with him, or I was with this girl, you know, a year ago and we were doing that. So it's like, these were some of my best friends. So when I look back at what the driving force that really got me to quit, it was like, if I was 28 years old and still like living with my mom and had no ambitions and never caught a break and this, like maybe I fucking, it would have gotten worse. That would have been like where I started really getting horrible and dark and this. But instead, that was the time where I was like, you know what? Like life is fucking good, man. Like appreciate it, you know, go enjoy it and this, and stop being your own worst enemy, you know?
It is really nice to hear that, you know, it's really nice to hear that, that honesty about that decision you made. Cause I think that is literally the converse to the normal story told, which is like, oh, you get sober because you fucked up everything and you're desperate to get it back because you're a former kid actor who needs the fame, versus someone who can recognize, you know, when I hear you speak, I hear you recognize the fact that all of the success that came your way and the people you got to work with, you really realized how grateful you are for it and what a blessing it's been in your life. And so that you've been able to then that, and that that's a really solid reason to change your life for the better. And it's that kind of decision versus, I don't know, chasing something. And I feel like that's just a version of former kid actor stories I just don't think are told, you know, and I relate to when you say it and then I see it in it. I think it's great. And I just want to comment that. I just think it's like a really beautiful thing to hear.
I think there's also like when you talk about chasing this, like there were so many people who I saw, and especially now more than ever, is like people just want to be famous, you know? And so with Instagram and I remember it was never like a big thing to me, but when I was like 12, 13, 14, and this started happening, I was like, oh, like being famous could be cool, but I don't really know how I feel about it. And then when I got arrested when I was 16, it was like, I had been doing all this stuff, right? Like charitable stuff. And I worked with the Special Olympics and this whole thing. And there was no press about it ever anywhere, which I was totally fine with. I was like, I don't expect there to be. Like, I'm doing this because it's a great thing to do. And then, but then when I got arrested, and I remember waking up in like the police station and seeing myself on the TV, and I was like, oh my God. I was like, I thought it was just going to blow over. Like, and here's one thing that bothers me more than fucking anything too, is like when actors get arrested, it's like they have this one line that sells papers, which is, this actor said, don't you know who I am? There is nothing. I gave them a fake name when I got arrested. And in the paper, in the paper, it was like Robert Eiler saying, like, don't you know who I am? Like, blah, blah, blah. And like, it could not be further from the truth. So it was like, I got arrested. I'm on the cover of the paper. And then they wrote, like, you know, I had a marijuana bowl on me and some marijuana. And they put, like, he was smoking a crack pipe when the police arrived and, like, all the crazy shit. And I remember leaving the police station. And you can't see outside from inside the police station. I remember getting outside. I had never seen, like, even, like, the Emmy red carpets had less photographers than when I walked outside and saw how many fucking photographers. And it was one of those things where, like, when I left the courthouse that night, you couldn't see in front of you and walk because there were so many flashes going off that it was one of those things where, like, you had to – it was fucking insane. And
that is insane. Wait, so you got busted for weed? You got busted for like a bowl of weed, and they say you smoked crack.
Weed's illegal now.
Yeah,
this is what we're talking about.
But I was like, man, if every you know that we've talked a lot about this, you're like, man, I literally don't know a 16-year-old that didn't smoke weed. Like, I don't know a single person. I know maybe two people actually. That's right. But everybody else I know.
And where are they now, Chris?
And where are those people smoking weed right now?
Right. And you know what's crazy? Like when I look back now, it's like I see. You know, the kids on Stranger Things, you know, like Millie Bobby Brown has like $100 million deal with it. She's selling like makeup. It's like, I was selling weed on Sopranos. Like literally, like I was trying to get kids in my school to buy like 20 bags from me while I was on the show. And I was like, oh, I could use, you know, the fact that I'm on the show to get them to fucking buy weed. And then I look now like 20 years later, I'm like, you know, I could have been selling fucking, well, these days, I don't know, hats.
You could get like a medical marijuana sponsorship and just like own a bunch of places.
I could add my own dispensary. It's like there's so much. So
we were just like a few years too early.
I just want to cap off that story real fast. We were so off track. But like, that is so fucking crazy. You're 16 years old. You know, you're not even a legal adult. And all of the photographers show up outside your court hearing. Are you with your mom at that point? Or like who picks? Are you just by yourself leaving or what?
The police officers are bringing me downtown to bookings. Like I had to go to the Tombs and like go through the whole thing. And it was just the fucking worst. And I remember the point of the story was after that, I was like, oh, I don't want anything to do with being famous. Like I never stopped on another fucking red carpet unless it was like somebody I knew or whatever. Like I had a couple of friends who were photographers in this and I would stop and say what's up to them. But like, I was just like, I'm done. I'm done with all of it. I don't want to be famous. I don't want to. So then it became like, well, I'm doing this because I love the acting and the acting is my passion. And then once I moved on to do other shows after Sopranos. And so it wasn't the acting. I'm like, oh, none of this is for me. Like I called my manager. I'm like, don't call me. You know, like, I'm like, give me 6 months. And I moved to Vegas to play poker and this. And I still, to this day, like he's like, hey, can I send you a script? I'm like, nope.
Yeah. I just about to say he's not going to give up. If he didn't give up when you were eight years old. He's not going to be giving up until he's like resting 6 feet underground. There's no way. He's like, and even then he's going to be like, hey, after I die, you see something good for Rob, you make sure you send it to him. That's amazing.
He's waiting for that one like weak moment I have, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Do you think that will ever come? Honestly, do you think that there might come some point where you're like, I don't know, somebody writes something and you, do you read it when he sends it? Do you even read it? Do you actually?
He stopped sending it. He knew not to send it anymore. Yeah, he doesn't send anything. But I did work on something not that long ago because it was a thing like that. But it's basically like if I had something where I had friends and it was something where I thought it would be fun and, you know, I thought, but I don't ever see myself like, all right, I'm driving to this audition again. And I just hope, maybe I will though. It's like when you were like a former addict and you've done so much work on yourself, it's like, if I told myself 10 years ago, like, hey, this morning you're going to wake up, go get a green juice and do yoga. Like I'd punch myself in the face, you know? So like to try and say now, like, hey, I'll never be the guy going on auditions. It's like, it could all change fucking overnight. You know, I could meet a girl who I love and we have a baby. And then I'm like, hey, you know what? I'm fucking singing song dance, man. You know, whatever I got to do. Like, so I don't know. And to try and say like I do is ridiculous, but I know, the way that now I see it is like, the way that this last thing I did was like somebody came to me and was like, hey, I was actually playing poker. And somebody was like, hey, man, I'm a poker player. Like, I'm also a writer. I got this project, this work. And another thing is a reason why I don't want to go and just audition for something is like, I always think if I got cast in something like Netflix, a TV show, and then they're like, all right, well, you're doing this and that. And I'm like, since I got sober, I have so many like restrictions on what I do and don't do and what I'll fucking eat and what I won't eat. And if they're like, oh, in this scene, you're smoking a cigarette. I'm like, no, I'm not. You know, if they're like, oh, in this scene, you're eating a bacon cheeseburger. I'm like, no, I can't do that. Like, I
the Speedo rule has really grown.
Yeah. and the thing is I don't think I'm talented enough to be one of those people who's like, oh, here's my list of 150 things I won't do. You know, like, oh, I will only work on such and such. Like, so I just instead, I'm like, you know, I love poker. I love playing poker. But I'm also, that's a thing where like, obviously with Corona and sitting at home for 9 months and you don't get to play that, I'm like kind of falling out of love with that. And it's, but podcasting is something I really love, but I don't know how many people there are out there making a full-time living and supporting a family with a podcast, but that's,
So did you ever find your new passion? Was it poker for a little while? Is it after the Sopranos?
Yeah, full on poker. And then when I got sober, it became like my health, you know? being healthy, exercising, figure out that, you know, first I was doing boxing and then I was doing yoga and then I moved over to this. And then I was like, oh, I just discovered like I really like cooking. So now like every day I try and cook like an organic meal and I'll watch things on how to become a better cook. And just my passion is like, I feel like it's like discovering these things that make you feel good when you wake up in the morning. So you don't want to do drugs, you know? It's also, you know, all of my friends that I had were friends that even if they were friends from the time I was, you know, 10 years old, it's like the way that our relationship grew was through partying and alcohol and drugs and this. So when I got sober, you know, whenever it was, to 28th birthday, I'm 35 now, 7.5 years, I had to figure a whole new life out. I remember not wanting to quit drinking because I was like, what is it going to be like to like walk up to a restaurant? Like, you know, like I was like, I don't even know. Or like, go like, what about if my friends has a birthday party? What about New Year's? Like, I'm going to go and see my friends on New Year's and not drink? Or like, what about, you know, I have friends who are
watch the ball drop on TV and clink club soda. What are we going to do?
Yeah. And then you find these things that you like. Now it's like, you know, my friend Eugene has this workout class called Rumble and it's this boxing thing. It's in New York and LA. And I do, and I'm like, oh, when I found that, I'm like, I'm fucking addicted to Rumble. You know, like you just find these things that you're like, and that's what I wish I could live back in New York City and do everything I wanted to in New York City. Cause what I love about like the greatest thing in the world about New York is like Saturday, you wake up, you don't have any plans and you're like, oh, there's a fucking, you know, 12 o'clock yoga class or boxing class. Like, I'll go do that. And then you're leaving that class and you realize you're like, oh, I'm a block away from Brian's place. Like, let me text him. And you text him and you're like, oh, you want to go grab lunch? And it's like, yeah, you go grab lunch. And then you're in like Central Park. And then you get home and you're like, I just had one of the greatest fucking days of my life. It was just absolutely perfect. Now I'm going to watch like one or two episodes of this show that I'm in the middle of and go to bed. And I'm like, before, you know, when I was partying and all this stuff, I would have been like, oh, that day sucked, you know? So well, I just like now, like I go with my friend to the beach and watch the sunset and have a nice dinner. And I'm like, man, what a fucking, yesterday was awesome. You know, it's like, and it was, I think another problem was I had like a crazy childhood and I didn't have the tools because, you know, no fault to my parents, but when they had me, they were super young and they didn't have the tools of like, hey, when things are really bothering you or your stress or life throws you that, like, how do you deal with it? You know? So it was like, I saw how people around me dealt with it, which was alcohol and drugs. And I was like, okay, like that's how you deal with it. And it's also like the bad times, but mainly like the good times, because when I was 16 or 15 and everybody's like, oh, we're going to parties. And I would get to a party and be like, I don't like this shit. Like, it's so crowded and people are stepping on my shoes. And then, but then it was like, oh, if I had fucking 3 drinks, I loved the party. Like, it was awesome. Where now it's like the tools could be as simple as, hey, if you don't like being at a party, leave. You know, we're like, I didn't even see that as an option. Right. It was like, how do I make myself enjoy this party? Or how do I fix these things? And it was just like, and now that I found, you know, working out and meditation and just doing all these things and listening to podcasts and all this stuff where like, you know, eating healthy. And it's like, oh, these are things that are not just, people don't just do this because they're fucking weirdos, you know? Like I was always like, I grew up where it was like, somebody who's doing yoga is a fucking weirdo. Like, absolutely. Yeah. Like if somebody in my family came back from vacation and they're like, we started meditating, like they would have gotten laughed out of the apartment.
I love it. It's a big change from like your buddy who's got the nail sticking out of his hat. You're like, he's cool. Man. Yoga, you guys are fucking weird.
Yeah. Like, so Rob, when you look back and early on you mentioned that you grew up in a household where you were told that there's the rich people and there's the poor people. There's not really choice. It's not like you work hard and you get ahead and you achieve the things that you want. And now looking back as these chance events that happened in your life, like this manager walking up to you on the street at 6 years old and then sticking with your parents and saying, you have to send them auditions. You have to keep them out there. And then you go on this audition and you say you get the job because the guy liked the way that you said fuck in the lines that were written there. These like chance things that happen. You didn't necessarily study acting. You didn't really try at this thing. These like quasi lucky events happened. Do you have a different appreciation for how things happen in life, how things change, like the different roads that people can go down as you now reflect back, especially coming from a place where it was like, you're rich or you're poor and that's it. There's no other options.
Well, for sure. You know, and it's also like, it sounds like there were a few things brought up that was like negative about the way I was raised, but there's also things that are so great of like, you know, Jamie talks about, I don't know if she talked about it on here, but she says like, you know, when she would go to auditions and she would come out, like her mom would be like, did they like you? Like, and she always, her whole life, even now, feels this pressure for everyone to like her, and every room she goes in, she wants to like please people in this. And I'm like, when we talk about that, I'm like, man, I've never felt that in my life. You know, like I've never, when I would go on auditions and they would be like, oh, sorry, we don't like it. My parents would be like, yeah, go fuck yourself. Like, you know, like her, it would be like, you know, you got a call back and then, you know, you didn't get picked for the role. It would be like, yeah, well, fuck them. Come on, let's go get a slice of pizza or like whatever. So as much as, you know, we talked about there's negative parts of it, but then there's great parts of it where I never felt, even when I remember, you know, there would be times in Sopranos where they would come to us and be like, all right. There was one specific time where David Chase, like I think HBO was coming to him with a big offer. And he was like, I can't keep working and working. Where he's like, if I could take a year off and then continue the show, I'll do it. So we were all at work and it was, I think it was a read through. And it was like, hey, all the main actors from the show stay and go in David's office after, which was something we never really did. And he took us inside and we were like, oh man, is this the end? Like, you know, what's going on? And he's like, HBO wants to know if, or this is the way I would do it. Is this okay with everybody else? If we take a year off, we don't shoot, we don't write, we don't nothing. And then we come back, or maybe it was 9 months or whatever it was. And he kind of went around the table asking people. And I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? You know, like, I'm like, yeah, I'm like, let's make it 2 years. Like, you know, I'm like, whatever. Like, I got the security of a job when I'm done partying. You know, it sounds great. But I remember as soon as that was done and people, you know, some people had to leave and they walk out, whatever. And we're all standing around, like, you know, finishing up sodas from the read through. And Edie and Jamie and Lorraine start talking about like, man, what do you think we should do? Like, I don't know, maybe I'll do a play. I've been wanting to do a play. And it was that pressure to like, man, we have some time off. What are we going to work on? And I was like, wow, I'm so unfamiliar with that. Like the only reaction to time off I've ever seen is the like throw the fucking hat, but like I'm out of this bit, you know, like I'm fucking out of here. I didn't even think being on Sopranos was a big deal until I turned 28 and got sober and all this stuff and kind of like stopped the just cycle and repeat of like drugs, party, alcohol, fun, this, like, you know, gamble, whatever. And taking a step back and looking at it all and being like, holy shit. And then there's that weird feeling of like, how come this doesn't happen to everyone? You know, how come four of my best friends are dead and I'm fucking, you know, I'm, when we got the call that there was a quarantine, I was like, oh, it's all right. You know, like I, as fucked up as, you know, coronavirus was, it wasn't something where I was like, oh my God, what am I going to eat? What am I going to this? I had like, how come I get to feel that fucking security, but everyone else doesn't, you know?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that for a lot of former kid actors, because your life can change so dramatically as an actor in general, adult or not. But when it happens to you as a kid, there's something that can happen to your life that's strange, right? You almost feel a little like plucked out of one place and put into another. And it can be displacing to what could have been your life. I had one weird question before we get to our last two questions we like to ask everybody. The question was this, just this random, I have this weird memory of reading something about The Sopranos a long time ago. I feel like it was in the news for a second that James Gandolfini had decided at one point he might not want to play the role. And I feel like I heard some story where he had walked into like a grade school and all the grade schoolers recognized him. And he was like really disturbed by it. And he was like, no, how do all these little kids look up to me? I'm this bad guy. You know, I'm playing this role. There's no way you should look up to me. And I feel like there was a moment where like it might not have, there was like a consideration. Maybe the news just blew this out of the water and it made wine out of water with it. But I'm just curious about it. I'm just wondering, like, one, do you remember that story? And two, did you ever have any part of that? Was there ever like because of the content of the show that you went, no, fuck it, I don't like this. You know, I didn't sign up for this at 12 years old.
No, not at all. And obviously, no offense to anybody, but I thanked God I wasn't on some like
Disney show.
Yeah.
AJ show.
I don't know how to put it, but yeah. I was like, man, because I, you know, trying to do that, because I feel like my personality with that would be like so like hiding drugs on the set of some like Pete and Pete type of thing. You know, way different than like bringing drugs to the set of Sopranos. You know what I mean? It's like my buddy Joey Perino, who was also on Sopranos, who when we would rap, like afterwards, he just caught a vibe off of me and he's like, yo, you want a Percocet? And I'm like, fuck yeah. Like, you know, it was like that. And it was, you know, there may or may not have been a bottle of Jägermeister hidden in the makeup trailer for when we rapped, you know, when things were done. Yeah. It was like, you know, I think my personality from being a kid who like grew up in, you know, on 83rd Street between 1st and 2nd Avenue and like a brownstone in Manhattan, who's my grandpa was the super, and this, like, it went well with, the Sopranos vibe that we went with, you know. It wasn't like all of a sudden I was at the Teen Choice Awards with like little girls screaming my name. And they, like, I don't know how the fuck I would have reacted. I don't know how that would have went. Like, it's such, like, I even remember me and Jamie one time, it was like the Hollywood Reporter Awards, Young Star Awards. And they're like, yeah, there's this award show and you and Jamie are nominated for best actor and actress in a series. And we're like, huh? Like, you know, like, what are you talking about? So we come out to LA and it was just, I mean, the feeling of we were the two different people, you could feel it in the air. Like, it was just, and Jamie's not that different. I think it was all me, you know, like I have like the fucking, the chain from the wallet coming to my fucking, and I'm like, you know, whatever we are, 14, I'm standing outside smoking this. And like the kid from like Seventh Heaven is like, girls are like screaming for him. And I'm like flicking my cigarette at him. Like, you know, or just like, that's the vibe I felt like, I'm like, we're so not supposed to be here, you know? And it felt very like, you know, and I remember like going home, my friends were like, dude, you went to LA. How was it? I'm like, that place fucking sucks. Like, you know, like, we're hanging in the park, dude. It's like, don't fucking worry about that shit. Like, they're like, oh man, dude, were you like surfing? I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about surfing? Like, you know, I was like, it was just, yeah, I'm like, you know, it's not like the movies. Like, you know, it's a bunch of weird. Even when I came out here, like the vibe of the stuff you see on Entourage, it was like Pepsi, Apple, Vincent Chase, like, you know, like all of a sudden for the first time, you got that vibe of like other managers coming to me and telling me why I should leave my manager. I'm like, who the fuck are you? I'm like, you're not my, I'm like, get the fuck out of here. It was just, it was so different from, because, you know, in New York City, you can go 3 years of your life without meeting someone in show business. You know, you come to LA for a fucking weekend and it's like almost impossible to not meet. So like, you can't go have a bite to eat.
You can't get a cup of coffee without, yeah.
Yeah. I remember I stayed here for a week one time and I was staying at the Roosevelt, and no joke, I had multiple scripts in the corner of my room. And it was just from people like, I'd be out at a club or this, and they'd be like, hey man, I got a script in my trunk and this. And I'd be like, dude, and I would try and, because I'm not going to carry your script around like the whole fucking thing. I would tell random people when I was partying, like, yeah, I'm staying at the Roosevelt, like drop it off there. And people would fucking drop off scripts with the fucking door. Like, I would come into the Roosevelt, they'd be like, Mr. Eiler? I'd be like, yeah. They're like, oh, someone left this for you. And I just had like a place in my room where I was tossing these scripts. I might have been here for like 2 weeks or whatever, but there were like four or five scripts in the corner where I'm like, I'm just throwing away 1,000 pieces of paper, you know? Like, it's just crazy. And in New York City, that my whole entire life, I mean, maybe one time someone came up to me and was like, I wrote a script, you know?
That's so funny.
That's amazing.
That is an accurate description of the difference between New York and LA, yeah, and being an actor in particular in New York and LA.
Yeah. And when you say to somebody in LA, like, hey, I'm an actor, like, no one's like, like, you know, like they're like, what have you been in?
Okay, what have you been in? Yeah,
secretly. Sorry, Hollywood. Like, you know, yeah. Like, they're, how can they bust your balls about it? We're like, in LA, it opens doors, you know?
It's, yeah. It's weird. That is weird. Well, we like to ask every guest at the end of this what two specific questions. And one is, if you got a kid at some point and some manager is walking down the street and stops you and your kid and says, oh my God, your kid's got to be in show business, I think your kid can do really well, what do you do? What do you say?
I mean, does he have the talent? Does he look like Robert Eiler? No. I don't have a kid, so to try and pinpoint an age is weird. But I would definitely, like, at 6, I would say no. But if there was like, you know, maybe if my kid was 12 and I felt like he was mature enough and he could do both things, and I actually thought, yeah, they really wanted to do it. Or if, like, you know, I had a little girl and she loved to sing and maybe she was a great singer. It's like, yeah, maybe I letting you pursue your dreams is one thing, but I wouldn't put my kid at an age where like they didn't know what was going on and just like be like walking them into audition rooms and being like, here, say this and I'll get you ice cream later. Like, you know, like, I'm not doing that shit. But if it's my kid's passion and they seem to really want to do it, I wouldn't be able to say no, I don't think. What about you guys?
Chris is in this predicament right
now. I'm in this predicament. I got this little baby and I terrorize.
She's got a little Gerber baby.
Yeah, she's a little beautiful baby. And I terrorize my wife all the time. I'm like, that baby's worth $1 million. If you get that baby headshots, she's going to be in commercials tomorrow. And I would know in no way, shape, or form put my baby in the entertainment industry. But I've just wondered, my wife's also an actress. So I've just wondered it. Like, since we got pregnant, I like had the dawning realization that I was like, shit, man, you're going to grow up with two actor parents and there's going to inevitably come some point where you're at least going to consider the possibility. And I have no idea. I really don't know how I'd react. I don't know. Because I didn't come from any entertainment family. So I came, you know, very similar. Like, I had parents in Jersey. Some friend of my mom said you should do this. And then the rest is history.
I have a feeling you're going to say yes, Chris, because you loved teaching people things. You love somebody comes to you and you're like, you need some advice? Let me give you some advice.
Here's the only thing is that I realize I don't have much else to pass on. That's the only thing. I'm like, what am I – like, I'm not college
educated.
Yeah,
you're great at it. You got this special skill.
I've never done anything else as a career, so I don't know what else to tell you. Hope you're just brilliant with numbers and can just be so the opposite of me. But she's allowed babies, but I really doubt it.
If you have a son, you could teach him how to get bullied.
Yeah, exactly.
You're great at that, Chris.
I mean, the truth is, I'll get him to acting if he gets bullied. I'll be like, you'll be fine. You'll get an insane amount of confidence for no reason, and you'll pick fights with everybody when you're a teenager.
I love how the one question that you guys want to ask everyone is the one where when they put it back on you, you're like, yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah, exactly. That's what we're doing.
Good question.
We're trying to take a consensus. We're trying to see what we should actually do.
We're taking a tally. So when you turned – I'm really curious to hear your answer. So when you turned 18 and you got access to your Coogan account, and I don't know if this is a California state law or if you have Coogan accounts in New York. You may not even – do you know what a Coogan account is?
I know because when Chris did my podcast, he told me what it is.
Okay, so Coogan accounts aren't a thing in New York then, are they?
I mean, I'm sure I know that there like had to be money put away and your parents could take out a specific amount this, but I don't remember like a thing that was like, it's 18 now and just seeing this crazy number, you know?
Right. But you got access to your money at 18 nonetheless.
Yeah.
And did you, so what's the weirdest thing or the dumbest thing that you spent your money on?
Nothing. I've never bought a car. I've never like as crazy, like, I mean, listen, I'm in a one-bedroom apartment. I could fill this apartment up with Percocets and Molly with the fucking money, the money I spent and all the fucking shit that I got. But as far as like, I've never bought a car. We've talked about this with Jamie on my podcast. Like when we wrapped, she got me a watch. And then I'm like, oh shit, that's right. You're supposed to like buy someone a gift. Like I forgot. And so I went and got her this like really expensive pair of earrings from like Barney. I remember being in Barney's and being like, everyone I walked in, like what, just walking in there, people were looking at me like, you're lost, you know? Like, and I'm like, I'm going up to the earring counter like, can I see those please? You know? They're like, yeah, okay, kid, you know? And then I bought my mother a car. When I think about it, one thing is like, when I turned a certain age, I went to the World Series of Poker and I bought into the main event for $10,000, which is like, you know, a dream. Like I was like, I can't wait. But I got like, there's 7,000 people and I got like 275th place. So it paid me like over 40 grand. So I can't be like, oh, that was one of the dumbest things I ever did. You know, it was like,
that was pretty smart. That's an amazing return on your investment.
Yeah. In 5 days, I like, you know, 4X my money or whatever it is, but it's, I really have never, I spent a lot of money on rent and food. And maybe like, yeah, that's really it. I'm not really like, I don't get a thrill from spending money because again, it's like that fear that I had always growing up of like, it's all going to be gone one day. I actually just told Jamie for the first time, because my manager told me that because we were in SAG this whole time, we have like a retirement fucking money.
You didn't know you had that? You got a pension.
Dude, I didn't know. I'm so dumb. I couldn't even find the word pension in my fucking vocabulary. But I didn't find out until very long after, like, I was probably 32 years old when my manager was like, no, yeah, well, like once you turn 55 or whatever, you get this. Oh my God, what a fucking weight off of my shoulders.
Like, I just got to make it to 55 and I'm good. I can sleep on couches until I'm 55.
Honestly, we can interview like 500,000 more people. We will never hear a better coming to moment of like, holy shit, I got a pension and I can retire.
And my manager is like, my manager tells me that. And I'm like, where are you? He's like, I'm in LA. I'm in New York. I'm like, I'm coming to give you a hug, man. Like, you know, I was just so, I was, and by the way, I told Jamie about this last year. She was 38 years old. She had no idea.
That's crazy. Yeah, she didn't know
they
either.
They could do a better job of letting people know that.
You should let some people know.
Well, also as an actor, you get the mail from SAG and you just, is it a check? Nope. Throw it in the trash.
Right. And also like me and Jamie, for me before I ever got into high school, but before she ever graduated high school, was on Sopranos. So it's like, I like the word, when you just said the word pension, I'm like, I know that word from like 60-year-old guys with gray hair and like, fucking, like saying that word, you know, I'm like, I never hung out with people who were like, man, so what about that pension?
that's so true.
You sleep like a baby that night, dude. I'll never forget the pension sleep. Oh man. Sleeping like a baby.
Dude, Rob, we can't thank you enough. This has been really fun.
I've just been enjoying sitting back and listening to these stories.
Yeah,
and,
dude,
and you've going got along for the ride. It was like I was in New York in the early 2000s, like living the glory.
And you didn't have to go bullying. You got to keep all your lunch money, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I didn't get robbed on the Rosie O'Donnell set. I'm all good. Dude, really, man, thank you so much for sharing so much yourself today. You've lived a really awesome, exciting life, and I'm so glad to see you become such a full, whole person that's so happy and energetic and enjoying your life so much. It's so fucking great to see. It really is. And it's so nice to reconnect with you after all this time. And yeah, man, and I hope we keep it alive.
Absolutely, man. Thank you guys for having me. This was
absolutely great. All right, guys, that concludes the episode.
Okay, guys.
AJ's trying to talk over me. AJ was great. It was great, wasn't it? It was a great job. It was really great. Everybody, listen to me. Don't listen to AJ. So listen, wasn't Robert awesome? He's hysterical. He's scary, isn't he? He doesn't scare me. I'm just kidding. He doesn't intimidate me still. He's not, we're over that. We got past the bully. He's not. Like the look in his eye doesn't sort of.
Did you feel a little tinge of it? But Chris, did you feel a little tinge of it come up? Did it bubble up a little bit?
I should have fucking told him when we were on there. No, not today when we did our, not when we did our interview, but when I came on his podcast, I hadn't seen him in 20 years. And one of his co-hosts I'm buddies with named Kasim G, and Kasim asked me to come on, and he knew we knew each other, but he didn't know that history. And I had the, like, you ever remember that Rick Moranis, Tom Arnold movie, Big Bully? You ever remember that movie?
No, but I'm going to go back and watch it. That sounds great.
Big Bully's great. Big Bully's the story of a guy who was bullied in high school. Rick Moranis was bullied by Tom Arnold, and they're now adults with families and stuff, and they run into each other as adults, and Tom Arnold is still a bully. And you're like, and Rick Moranis is still terrified of him. And the whole point is like, no, he's a good person. You'd stop being scared. But also, like, it brings out something in Tom Arnold, you know, of like, oh yeah, you little asshole. You know, it's like, it just brings that out. And so I think I actually talked about that with him on the podcast, because I did get that feeling when I first saw him. It was a little like, don't hurt. Are you going to hurt me? What are you going to do? It's just like a little. Anyway, he didn't, guys. And he's fucking awesome. And it was awesome to reconnect with him. And that movie, The Tick Code, we did was a real special thing for me in my life. And so it's great that, we got to connect here, and I'm glad we enjoyed it. And so we'll let you guys go. Look forward to next week, where we have his counterpart to The Sopranos, his older sister on the show, a wonderful actress named Jamie Lynn Sigler. She's going to join us and talk more Sopranos and more stuff and talk more about Rob.